Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White. I'm not able to be joined by my usual colleague, my dad, John White, today, but very pleased to say that we have a guest on the show, which is Richard Reddy. How are you, Richard?
I'm fine, thank you. Great to be able to join you.
For those who've not come across you and your work before, would you mind introducing yourself, Richard, and telling us a little bit about what you do when you're not appearing on podcasts?
Yeah, so Richard Reddy, I'm the Director of Justice and Inclusion for Churches Together in Britain and Ireland. So I take a real interest in issues around justice, inclusion, equality, diversity. In terms of my work, I am responsible for taking forward the resources that the church has used to mark Racial Justice Sunday, which is the second Sunday in February. It's an annual event, so I do that. I'm also one of the coordinators for the Church's Refugee Network, CRN for short. The chair of that is the Bishop of Dover, the Right Reverend Rose Hudson Wilkin. And again, that involves churches kind of just being a little more proactive on issues around asylum and immigration. And I also work closely with Reverend Dr. Indigit Bogle. I'm sure some of your listeners are familiar with him, and he is the lead for the Church of Sanctuary Initiative. One of the other things that I do is I'm the vice chair now of something called the Synergy Network. And the Synergy Network is a growing number of churches and parachurch organizations, as well as individuals, who are encouraging Christians to get more involved in the work to address what some call violence affecting young people. Knife crime, or what some used to call serious youth violence. You know, I describe it as a scourge that sort of impacts certain communities in Britain and Ireland, but it's very much a growing sort of phenomenon. And, you know, for me, you know, you call this podcast Matters of Life and Death. Well, issues around violence affecting young people are often matters of life and death, and it's trying to ensure that our young people actually traverse the you know, the choppy waters from adolescence to adulthood, so that they can become the next generation of lawyers, teachers, doctors and preachers, rather than languishing in prison or sadly in cemeteries. So to me, that is a massive issue as well. So that's what I do as business as usual. Outside of that, take a real interest in issues connected to culture, religion, just generally life, to be honest. I'm a Christian. I worship at St. James C of E Church in South West London, married with a son.
Well, thank you. For those who've not come across Churches Together, could you just give a very brief explanation of what that organisation is all about?
Yeah, so Churches Together in Britain and Ireland, not to be confused with Churches Together in England, is an ecumenical body that encourages Christian unity. So in terms of who we seek to sort of represent, we kind of, in sort of membership, we have Christians from the three sort of major traditions. So we're talking about Orthodox Christians, Catholics, as well as Protestants in all their sort of ways, shapes and guises. So that includes evangelicals, it includes sort of Pentecostals, but also, you know, Church of England, the Methodist Church, but also the, you know, the kind of a non-conformist sort of denominations and groupings as well. So it's really the full gamut of, you know, what we would kind of consider to be Trinitarian Christians. And we encourage Christian unity. That's you know, the it's what John 17:21 through 22, where Jesus says, you know, that they may be one just as the Father and I are one. So those verses really have a sort of a watchwords that kind of sort of take forward our work for Christian unity. And we are you know, our primary resource for that would be the resources that we produce annually for the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity, which is generally the third week in January, but we do so much more than that. And as Churches Together in Britain and Ireland, we are active across the four nations. So that includes Scotland, it includes Wales, it includes England, and for us, Ireland is one jurisdiction, both north and south. So yeah, it's about trying to encourage churches to work together, you know, to be encourage unity, which, you know, for some it's a bit like herding cats, but there you go.
Brilliant. Well, it's great to have you on the show, Richard. I'm really looking forward to a conversation. What we want to talk about today was, as a lot of listeners will know, in my kind of day job, I'm a kind of church news journalist, and so I write a lot about the Church of England in particular. And one of the kind of major controversies that has been coming up, bubbling up over the last few years, is what is known as Project Spire. I know you'll know all about it, Richard, but for the benefit of our listeners, particularly those not in the UK, Project Spire, in brief, it was found out of some historical research that the Church of England did, which found that some of the predecessor charities that kind of managed the Church of England's historic assets were involved in investing in slave trading companies. This is centuries ago in the 17th and 18th centuries. And as a result of finding out this very unpalatable news, the Church of England decided that they wanted to put aside £100 million of their assets, their investments, into a new special fund that will be dedicated to doing impact investment for kind of Black, African, Caribbean communities to try and, if in effect, make recompense for their historic involvement in slavery. And this hasn't actually been set up yet. It's still been a kind of torturous process of getting all the new funds set up. But it's triggered an enormous, quite angry backlash in many parts. And we don't want to go into all of the technicalities about why people are upset about it. But one of the things that really jumped out to me was this: some people really reject the idea that the Church of England today bore any kind of moral responsibility for the sins of its forebears. And we wanted to kind of drill into that question in the context of the legacy of slavery. But just first off, Richard, what is your take on Project Spire? Do you think it's fundamentally a good idea for the church to be pursuing?
I think people sort of use or discuss this kind of issue within the context of reparations. I always like to use the term reparatory justice, which is, I think that's a more sort of a biblical term, although I think the whole phrase reparations has become a loaded one, where people simply equate it with money. I think, you know, the whole issue of reparatory justice is about restoration, it's about repair, it's about recovery, it's about just making amends, making, well, justice really, or seeking to address the effects of, you know, of the past. I think it's, I don't think it's a bad thing that the Church of England is seeking to do, you know. I sort of like to consider this sort of work as part of the Church's work to sort of address issues around equality, diversity and inclusion. So, you know, not so long ago, you know, I think it was 2020/2021, the Church came out with that report from Lament to Action, which spoke about the failure of a church over decades to really address issues of race inequality. And to me, I see this work as being sort of part of that particular continuum, you know, addressing, you know, the what some would consider to be the sins of the past, so that we can have a more sort of inclusive, have a more equitable future collectively as Christians. I mean, I've just come back from Jamaica. I was in Jamaica for most of August, and you know what you can't miss there. Is a history of enslavement. You know, the actual individuals there, the vast majority are of African heritage, and you know, they were brought there as enslaved individuals. And when one looks at that particular history, the Church, particularly the Church of England, have an inextricable, you know, indelible role in all of that. You know, you only have to look at the power of a church in places like Jamaica, You know, you've got clearly you've got Baptist churches there, but also you've got the Church of England, and the fact that you know, the vast majority of individuals there are Christian. They have what some would consider to be Christian names, as opposed to sort of traditional African names, and you know, that's largely the work of a church. So that's the legacy of all of this. So you know, how can one address that? How can one properly address that? And I know that, for instance, the you know, we're expecting a visit from the Jamaican government, or rather representatives from the Jamaican government, a Jamaican delegation this week, looking at the whole issue of reparations. And they will be meeting with members of the church, I think, including the Church of England, to talk about how to address those issues of the past. So, so to me, I think it's consistent, and I think it's fair. I think for the church to be Church of England to be addressing, you know, what it did in the past, and seeking to sort of make amends for that. I mean, the whole figure of £100 million. I mean, initially, there was a lot in the media, and there was a lot of information, and there was a lot of misinformation with regard to that figure. I know that for a fact. I still think it's, they're considering it to be, I think we're using the term an endowment fund. But you know, it's not for reparations. They're not using the word or the term reparations within this particular context. But you know, it's you know, for me, it is reparations. But you know, for want of another word. So yeah, I think it's fine. I think the, you know, fascinating how they came up with this figure of. 100 million. That's quite interesting as well. Why 100 million? And again, there's been lots of sort of misinformation about, you know, I think the we were talking about the, or they were talking about the Queen Anne's bounty, and how much money was accrued within the Queen Anne's bounty over, you know, a period of time. And I saw anything from a billion to 10 billion, you know, in terms of figures. And again, it's, you know, again, it seems to be sort of unclear in that respect. But 100 million, I know that in terms of the conversations that I've had with individuals, just seem to be a very sort of arbitrary figure. You know, where did that come from? I mean, it's not an inconsequential sum. It's a large amount of money. But, you know, when one considers how much money was made by institutions, and that's not just the church, from this particularly heinous endeavor. 100 million, one would then say, well, is that commensurate with the sorts of monies that the church actually accrued from that? Mm-hmm. So yeah, just to sort of answer your question, yeah, I think it's right that the church is engaging in this kind of activity. It's you know, it's what the church should be doing, what the Church of England should be doing, but also I think what churches per se that were involved in this particular activity, you know, in some way, shape or form should be doing. You know, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but between 2005 and 2008, when I worked for Churches Together in England, that's not to be confused with Churches Together in Britain and Ireland, and it can be confusing. I was the project director of something called Set All Free, and Set All Free was the churches of churches in England, the historic churches as well as the sort of kind of newer churches, attempt to mark Britain's bicentenary of its abolition of the slave trade. So you're talking about 2007, and what was fascinating about that particular sort of bicentenary event was the fact that the churches were very keen to talk about the work that they did to end slavery. So we were talking about abolitionists, and you had evangelicals sort of talking about William Wilberforce, John Newton, the Clapham sect, or as Eric Williams pejoratively called them, the Clapham Saints. And then you had the Quakers talking about the work that they did in terms of, you know, the abolition movement, particularly from 1785/1787, you know, individuals like Thomas Clarkson. But what the churches didn't do or weren't so keen to talk about was, you know, how they colluded in this particular enterprise and provided the spiritual and all sometimes a moral justification for enslaving Africans. And they were part of a sort of an enterprise that involved, you know, commerce, Christianity, and so-called civilization, not only in Africa, but also in the Americas, particularly in the Anglophone Caribbean. So it was very much at that point a tale of, you know, not two halves, but one half. Let's talk about abolition, but let's not talk about our involvement in this particularly nefarious enterprise. So, I mean, for me, you know, what the Church of England's doing and what other churches, other denominations are actually doing now at this particular juncture is actually historic truth telling. It's recognizing the fact that, you know, what happened was wrong. For me, it went, it was contrary to scripture in terms of particularly, you know, a gospel message of liberation and freedom. You know, a famous individual once said, the truth sets you free. So what is the truth within this particular context? Well, it was the fact that the churches did collaborate in a pretty ungodly, nefarious kind of enterprise and profited from that. And for me, that's blood money. You know, that's money that they really should feel uncomfortable having. And given the fact that, you know, when you look at the church, particularly the Church of England in parts of London and parts of Birmingham and Manchester, a good number of their congregations are individuals of African heritage, you know, people of from the Caribbean, you know, the descendants of enslaved Africans. And, you know, how can you honestly look those individuals in the eye knowing that, you know, sometimes, you know, you know, some of the buildings that you have and some of the stained glass windows that you've got and even some of the language that you use is oppressive and it's, you know, and it sort of is a result really of activities that the churches of the Church of England engaged in the 17th and the 18th century in particular. But also, let's not forget parts of the 19th century as well.
Hmm. Lots of points I'd love to pick up on there. Let's start with that question about, because I think you're right, it's really interesting how much attention was paid to that bicentenary of the abolition of slavery in 2007. And the argument I've heard many times from some people who say, look, the Church of England did do some bad stuff, it was involved in slavery, but it then, after abolition, helped to abolish slavery, and then Britain as a nation, you know, put a lot of effort into trying to stamp out slavery beyond its own borders. In that sense, the argument goes, the slate has been wiped clean. We've balanced out our original sin of slavery with then, you know, 100 years of good work in trying to abolish and wipe it out elsewhere. Do you have any credence for that argument that we've already kind of made amends in the past?
No, not at all. None whatsoever. I mean, let's face it, you know, when I think of the Church of England, my parents were part of a Windrush generation, came over in the 40s and the 50s. My parents came over actually in the 50s. And when I think of how the Church of England responded to their arrival on these shores, they didn't receive a warm Christian welcome whatsoever. And a lot of the time, you know, they were encouraged not to come back. And I'm not saying that that rejection sort of gave birth to black churches, because that's not the full story of a whole story. And a lot has been written about that. But, you know, we need to remember that, you know, so this idea that somehow, you know, after whether you're talking about 1807 or 1834/1838, the church, or in terms of church we're talking about here, the Church of England, became good guys and never did any wrong. Well, that's not the case. You know, you go to the Caribbean, they were still part of a colonial enterprise that sought to oppress and marginalize largely black individuals. You know, they didn't have an issue with the importation of indentured laborers from what we now call South Asia. to Lightning the Africans and those South Asians in places like Guyana and Trinidad and Jamaica were exploited. I wouldn't say they were exploited in the same way as the Africans were exploited, but the church, again, didn't have a problem with any of that whatsoever. You know, you kind of look at the sort of a whole missionary stroke colonial enterprise after slavery, and you're talking about the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s. It's sort of a missionary Christianity that encouraged or sought to perpetuate this notion that, you know, black folks at best were second-class citizens, but, you know, often unworthy of salvation, and if they were worthy of salvation, you know, they were encouraged to worship, you know, a white saviorism, and the legacies of that are still with us now. You know, that sort of, you know, sort of white god syndrome, and a lot has been written about that, and most of it is quite interesting as well. But again, that's a lot of that is the legacy of what the churches did. And I'm sure you've had that conversation about the slave Bible that was produced in 1807. Now there's some debate as to who actually produced it, but we do know that I think it was the Bishop of London, who clearly is a Church of England, had a hand in the production of that particular resource. And again, that was, you know, well disseminated throughout the Anglophones, Caribbean, English-speaking Caribbean, amongst black folks. You know, they never withdrew that after enslavement. You know, it's something that, you know, they continue to sort of propagate and perpetuate amongst African people. So, you know, the legacy in terms of...
We should just explain, people who don't know, the Slave Bible was a kind of Bible where they had taken out key passages from the scriptures, which might appeal to people seeking kind of liberation stories about the Israelites being saved from slavery and phrases like that. Is that the one you're referring to?
Yeah, more or less, yeah. I mean, if we say keep... Well, someone said as much as something like 90% of the scriptures were actually deleted. So, you know, if you see a physical copy of it, you look at it and you think, but that's not the Bible. You know, there's no 66 books in it. All of Exodus is missing. And any passage that sort of speaks about freedom, liberation, speaks about God intervening on behalf of the oppressed or the marginalized as being expunged, and anything that speaks about enslavement is... you know, I would say they extrapolate those, they expand them. So really, you know, it was written for the purposes of, I would say, indoctrination. You know, I've got what language they use on the preface of this Bible, but it's described as a holy Bible. You know, as a Christian, well, initially I didn't believe it existed. I thought it was, you know, particularly when it comes to slavery, you read a lot of stuff that, you know, isn't true. It's, you know, it's fanciful. And I thought that was the case. You know, I thought it was some sort of story that was perpetuated by individuals who really kind of didn't like the church, really had it in for the church. So to actually... come across a real copy of the Bible, this particular version of the Bible did shock me. And I remember going to the Lambeth Palace Archives two, three years ago, just opposite St. Thomas's, and seeing a physical copy of it and just being sort of just shocked by what I saw. And again, just reading the preface in terms of, you know, why this Bible was produced. And it was really there. You know, some would call it indoctrination, others would call it brainwashing. But, you know, I think it is Revelation 22, it says anyone who adds to this or takes from this book, you know, they should be cursed. And you're going to think, well, you know, to produce something like this, church folk to come together to, because you don't just, you know, do that on a whim. It's, you know, this is something intentional. You know, to produce something like this for the purposes of just sort of misleading or brainwashing individuals, to me, that's the devil's work. You know, there's nothing saintly or godly in that. That's, you know, old-fashioned language, but, you know, just come back from Jamaica and I like to use terms like that. This is the devil's work, you know, in terms of this particular book, because there's nothing holy in that. You don't, you know, the fact that you strip so many sort of powerful passages away from it, you know, nothing about liberation or freedom. You know, it's just about oppression, and that to me, that's not God's word. You know,
it's quite a shocking, isn't it, to compound the original sin of which is such a grievous sin, to enslave other precious image-bearing children of God, to then compound that by having the blasphemous effrontery to try and edit the word of God to justify that is like a layer of sin upon sin that is it is kind of breathtaking to comprehend.
Well, it is. I think the term blasphemous is appropriate in this particular context, because, you know, it's taking what is sacred, what is holy, and then distorting it, you know, twisting it, you know, for nefarious reasons. And, you know, again, that to me, that's not, you know, there's nothing saintly or godly in that. That's, you know, that's demonic, really. You know, I can't see, you know, people who call themselves Christian, true Christians, being willing to do that. But again, that to me, when I think of the church's actions or activities within this particular period, I think, you know, don't get me wrong, not everyone was like that. But I think to me that was more or less the default position. I mean, if you know anything about, you know, church-related activity, particularly during the period of African or transatlantic African chattel enslavement, you know, there was very little true missionary sort of activities amongst Africans. They didn't preach the gospel to them at all, and when they did, it was very skewed, and it was, you know, there's very little about, you know, being made in the image of God. Genesis 1:27, you know, that was never really sort of recounted to the Africans. And let's face it, you know, the fact is they were never encouraged to read. So somebody would always have to read the Bible to them, i.e. the pastor or the minister. And they were very selective in terms of what they read. If they read the Bible, very selective in terms of what they read to them. You know, there are accounts of individuals who went to the Caribbean with, you know, with some of a real sense of, you know, sincerity to preach the good news, and were encouraged not to do so, and if they did, they got into trouble. So so much they were corrupted by actually physically being in places where, you know, if there was enslavement, so they just basically went with the flow, you know, so came there perhaps with good intentions and realized that, you know, if I actually come here and I preach the gospel to these enslaved Africans, I'm going to get into trouble. So rather than actually challenge an oppressive system, they just sort of went with the flow and got co-opted, or some would say corrupted. So that to me is the, you know, that's largely the story. I don't think they've wiped the slate clean in any way, shape or form. You know, they were part of an oppressive system that, you know, kind of continued well into the 20th century. And, you know, you a lot of the time, you know, the church ends up apologizing for what it did. You know, like I said, the truth sets you free. And if you actually look at that particular history, very little to be proud of, to be honest.
Yeah.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
I guess there's a broader question which sometimes comes up in this conversation, which is that few people today, thankfully, would seek to deny the kind of scale of the church's historic sin, the injustice and the oppression it was involved in. But does it necessarily follow that people today in the church should bear the kind of responsibility for atoning for that sin? Is that a Christian idea, that kind of historic sin should be dealt with by people who actually didn't commit it themselves, but are in some sense the kind of successors to, or the inheritors of? Well, what do you make of that on a kind of more theological, moral question?
I mean, again, a lot has been written about that. I think people need to be aware of the church's history, you know. So if you are a member of the Church of England, you need to be aware what the Church of England was involved with, and also whatever legacies of that, and how the legacy is being played out today, and are you a beneficiary of any of those particular legacies? So that includes, you know, looking at your church's history, you know, looking at the actual building itself, and sometimes, you know, the churches were beneficiaries financially of a largesse of individuals who were engaged in these particular activities. So whether you're talking about, you know, a font somewhere in the corner or a stained glass window or somebody sort of helping to actually construct the building, you know, that is important. So, you know, you need to be aware of that. But also, you know, for me, it's about, you know, the prayers that we say, it's about the hymns that we sing, it's about the language and the, let's say, even the liturgies that we use as well. You know, how helpful are they? Are we perpetuating or continuing to use language that is unhelpful in this particular sort of context? So to me, it's sort of looking at the issues of the past and seeing, you know, what are the legacies of that, you know, what issues of the past are currently being played out today, and are there ways that we can sort of address them, particularly if you're sort of, you're going to a church that is quite, or you attend a church rather, that is diverse, you know, ethnically or demographically diverse. And you know, some of the individuals with whom you worship are people who are from, you know, particularly from an African or an African Caribbean context. I think it's recognizing again that, you know, the events of the past continue to inform the present. You know, you don't just draw a line under things, and you know that there are things called legacies, and they tend to be played out, you know, in some subtle ways, and sometimes some very unsubtle ways, and you know, people need to be aware of that.
So it's not, what would you say are the impacts for people of African heritage today, obviously born centuries after slavery was abolished? How do you think we can see the impacts or the legacy of slavery in those communities today?
In many ways, actually. I mean, what's been fascinating, I'm sure you've probably sort of had conversations about this, and you know, you've you know, we had that tragic sort of passing of Professor Jason Ade, and what's been interesting, interesting is not the right term to use, I need to use a better term than that, but what's been intriguing, if let me use that word instead, has been the way in which the kind of the forensic way in which some individuals, particularly those on the right, sort of were looking at this individual. This is Jason Ade, looking at his credentials and you know, whether he had the requisite experience and qualifications to actually take up a role such as the one he had at Cambridge, and then using that to then look at other academics and individuals in positions of authority or power within universities, and more or less suggest that somehow they lack the experience, they lack the wherewithal, the qualifications, and the more or less intellectual capacity to actually carry out those roles. And we do know that the individual who was investigating, and I'm not going to name him, Jason Ade, described himself as a race realist. And as far as he was concerned, black folks, you know, they should do nothing more than entertain and play sport. And that notion of entertaining and playing sport were ideas and theories that have their history in enslavement. You know, so, you know, the slave was someone who clearly was capable of working, but if they weren't working, they were there to entertain their white masters. So they, you know, so whether you're talking about playing music or dancing or doing sport, and historically, those were the areas, particularly in the United States, but also in the Caribbean and at some point in this country, which were only open to Black Fox in terms of success, you know, entertainment as well as sports. You know, you weren't able to pursue if you're going to use the term career outside of those particular spheres, to the point where, you know, people flourished in those areas. But that doesn't mean that that's all you can do, because that's reductive and that's nonsensical. You know, the fact is, you know, given the opportunity, you can do all kinds of things. And what that has led to is, not only in this country, but also in America, you know, this whole notion of first. So, you know, when Professor Valip, Professor Rade was appointed to his role, we were told that he's the youngest, he's the first black, I think either the youngest or the black professor in Cambridge. And it was very much seen as a first. You know, and you're constantly seeing, oh, he's the first this, and oh, she's the first that. And this notion of first, and sometimes you're first and last, but it's this sense that that's not the norm. You know, this individual who is doing this role is a trailblazer. You know, they're pioneers, which in and of itself is not a bad thing. But, you know, it's as if they're the exception as opposed to the rule. And the rule really is you kind of expect to see black faces doing certain roles or carrying out certain activities, and sport has been one and entertainment has been another, rather than them sort of playing out roles, you know, being a doctor or being a teacher, or just being something other than entertaining people. So that's part of a legacy, and it's this sense for me where. And as I've said, you know, people, and I'm aware of people who have contacted me since the, you know, the tragic sort of death of Jason Ardi, and they've been contacted by journalists, folk and media, who have asked them, you know, were you a DEI, you know, a diversity hire, you know, you know, you didn't get your role because of your ability. But you got it because they wanted, you know, you were a tick box, you know, you looked good, you know, for the organization. So it's not a question of your ability. It's a question of, you know, they just needed somebody of your color, you know, to actually, you know, take up this particular role. So it's a, you know, it's that whole notion again. And it's, you know, the you know, you've got a whole history of what some would call race science. And that's connected to eugenics, where, you know, certain individuals, but not certain so-called races, were deemed to be the lesser races. You know, you think of the kind of the whole Enlightenment movement, you know, 18th and 19th century, who were kind of a lot of the kind of the individuals who were kind of prime movers in that, were propagating these particular notions of the lesser races, you know, individual races that, you know, were somehow inferior intellectually, maybe perhaps superior physically, but from an intellectual perspective, were lesser. And clearly, in terms of black folk, they kind of fell into that particular category. And I think we're still seeing the legacies of that are still with us today, in terms of how particular individuals are seen. You know, they've got their role not because of their ability, but because, you know, it was to do with something connected to diversity or inclusion. You know, you just needed a black face in a white space.
Yeah, and tragically, as you said, a lot of those figures who have been pushing that kind of junk science and eugenicist ideas were people of faith as well, which is really sobering when you reflect on it.
But also, I mean, it would be comforting to believe that those ideas are dead. But there are plenty of individuals, I'm not going to name them, who are around now, who are associated with some pretty prestigious universities and academic institutions, who still adhere to a form of, you know, eugenics, you know, race-based, so-called race science. And that to me is deeply worrying. And again, as you say, you know, these individuals are connected to the church. Some would openly call themselves Christians. Some would call themselves cultural Christians. But you know, to me, those ideas, I had hoped to sort of died with the Nazis, because that's who I associate them with. You know, that's Nazi ideology, completely discredited, and it should have disappeared with with Hitler and his cohorts. But you know, sadly, it's those ideas are still alive and well, and percolating and fermenting in some of our most prestigious academic institutions.
Mm. I wanted to come back to one other thing we talked about earlier in the conversation about idea of reparations or the Church of England's kind of idea of creating this kind of investment, impact investment fund. For those who accept that there is a kind of historic guilt to be atoned for, do you think a financial transaction is the right way to deal with it? Is that a particularly Christian idea that you can cleanse your guilt by paying money, whether directly or indirectly, to the kind of aggrieved party? Or do you think the church should think about more kind of creative ways rather than simply writing a check and thinking that kind of solves its problem?
I don't know. I kind of struggle with that whole term guilt. I mean, I think it has to be more than just guilt. So, you know, if you look at the whole issue of reparations and again, there's a legal framework for reparations, and, you know, the United Nations have sort of pulled together language and terminology as to what constitutes reparations. And clearly it's not solely financial. You know, you're talking about something that is holistic. You're talking about an activity where, you know, you recognize the wrong that was done. Just give me a minute. I'm going to try and show you something that I helped to produce. It's called We Will Repay, and it's a Bible study that, here it is. There you go. So it's the biblical case for reparations. And in it, one of the things we say is that, the issue of money or finance is a part of a conversation, but it can't be just about that. You know, it's about restitution. It's about rehabilitation. It's about satisfaction. It's about guarantees of non-repetition. Finance is there. It is a part of it, but it's not solely that. It has to be done within a more sort of holistic context. I mean, also from a Christian perspective, it's part of a conversation around recognizing that a wrong was done, and how do you then right a wrong? You know, what's the process involved in that? Well, for me, there is a sense of lament. You know, recognizing that you've done something wrong. So lament has to be a part of that. Then there's a sense of making amends. And, you know, again, lament, making amends, apologizing, that sort of thing. But then there's an action part of it, in terms of how then by your actions can you address address as in right the wrongs of the past. And clearly, you know, some would say that there's an aspect in terms of finance, but it's more than that. So, for instance, you know, for me, when I, you know, when we started this conversation, I mentioned from lament to action. I think that particular methodology is a good one that really should be encompassed within the church's work to address its legacy in terms of its involvement with transatlantic African chattel enslavement, where, you know, you kind of think to yourself, well, clearly something went wrong, but, you know, how do we address, you know, those events of the past in terms of, you know, issues around equality, particularly when it comes to African and African Caribbean people in Britain, you know, those who worship within our structures at the moment. What are we doing to ensure that, you know, their experience as Christians, as believers, is one in which there is equity, one in which there is a justice, one in which there is dignity and respect in terms of who they are and how they worship within our particular structures. So, you know, from a church perspective, I always say, for instance, you know, are black Christians able to exercise their God-given giftings to take forward the work of a church? Now, that doesn't necessarily mean you know, you becoming a priest or a vicar, but you know, what about, you know, some sort of leadership role? Because in far too many churches, and this is part of work that I do in terms of my racial justice aspect, you know, you have a church where the leadership doesn't reflect the makeup of a congregation. You know, to me, addressing the legacies of the past means ensuring that the church does have a leadership that's commensurate with the composition of a congregation. But it also ensures that in terms of, you know, the actual, you know, those who actually are given the opportunities to candidate for ministry, they're supported in all of that. You know, again, you know, the amount of people who have come to me as, you know, within the Church of England and have said, you know, I would really love to serve on the PCC, but constantly being overlooked. And then, you know, others who have said, you know, when I've actually been invited to be part of a PCC, the actual sort of how the PCC works and, you know, has never been explained to me. So the idea is that, you know, I sit on this and also they say, well, I don't want to, you know, I've been invited to be a part of a PCC. I really don't want to ask too many questions about how it works because I don't want to appear stupid. But at the same point, you know, business takes place. I'm expected to vote on things. I don't know what's happening, so I either stay silent or I just go with the flow. But in for some people, that's a deliberate ploy just to ensure that, you know, they don't rock the ball. So a lot of stuff I think that the churches can do to address the legacies of the past. You know, like I said, I think the old notion of guilt and shame, yeah, that's a part of it, but it can't be all of it. You know, there's a sense of lament, a sense of recognizing that wrong was done. Money, it can't be just solely about money. But what's fascinating about the money is, you know, when it came to end slavery, you know, we talk about the work of, you know, well, it wasn't really Wilberforce at that point because he more or less stepped down from Parliament in 1823. It was Thomas Fowell Buxton, wasn't it, really? But Thomas Clarkson was still active in the work. But, you know, moral kind of persuasion only went so far. You know, what really kind of tipped things was that £20 million in compensation. That's really what persuaded, you know, the owners to actually give up their enslaved Africans and to an extent some of their properties in the Caribbean. So at the end of the day, you know, finance was a part of it. So money was a part of it, and money was given to them, and no money was given to the Africans. And what was interesting was in some Caribbean countries, money was meant to be set aside for the education of Africans. And I think that didn't happen. I think they were given religious instruction instead. And again, as I said, some of that religious instruction was little short of brainwashing. It didn't help them. It wasn't something that was designed to liberate them. Because again, and this goes back to what I was saying, you know, at the time, particularly at that time, you know, in the 1830s, 1840s, many in the church didn't really see Africans as being capable of running things themselves. You know, they had a very sort of patronizing sort of attitude towards them. You know, it was, you know, the Africans are seen as children, you know, more or less, not in a position to run things themselves. And, you know, it was very much, as a society, it was, you know, they weren't deemed to have, you know, the wherewithal to actually do anything for themselves and were, you know, regarded as being, you know, basically at the behest of white patronage. And the church is a key part of that, you know, and you only have to look at the literature that came out of the time, you know, from the church that seemed to address that. Not even then, I mean, much later, right? You know, when I was growing up, I used to collect money for the Junior Missionary Association, GMA, and, you know, some of the literature that we used to send to parts of Africa, you know, in terms of the money that we would collect for overseas mission. You know, it was, you know, you look back on it now and you shake your head. I'm trying to think, I've got my long service Junior Missionary Association medals, you know, on me that I collected, you know, what was it, 7 years, I've got a long service medal. And all this money was sent to generally to Africa, to kind of teach these young people in particular about Jesus. But, you know, it was, you know, they were using language at the time that was, you know, it's kind of cringeworthy, you know, and I think it's so cringeworthy that nobody talks about it now. And that's how I think that's how things are. You know, it's a kind of an era where we don't look back on that with any sense of pride.
No. And I think your main point is really an important one that, you know, I often, when you hear sermons about kind of individual sin, and I've often heard pastors and preachers talking about that repentance has to be more than just feeling bad that you did something wrong. It has to mean turning around and going the other way. It has to involve a kind of commensurate action. And so, as you say, there's no good for the church to kind of simply wring its hands about its racial injustices of the past if it isn't also taking action to try and address racial injustice here in the present as well. And that, as you said, will look like all kinds of things.
As you speak, things just kind of come to mind. Repentance is massive, but also it's this sense of... You need to talk to those people who have been harmed, those survivors, you know, and ask them, you know, what do they want? Because a lot of the time, you know, so for instance, 100 million, I don't know who they consulted, you know, who they spoke to about this. It might seem like a good idea, but, you know, in terms of being benevolent. But it's, again, I think in terms of a sort of a methodology, I think it's a poor one. You know, I know that, you know, within a Caribbean context, some of the churches have been, and you know, there's you know, the work that I do at Church Again Britain and Ireland brings together churches, parachurch organisations and mission agencies who are taking a real interest in reparatory justice. And some of them are engaging with churches and Christians in the Caribbean. And it's part of a process. So it's not a one-off thing. You don't just give people money and then just run off. But it's part of a process. It's about engagement. It's about talking to individuals, ensuring that they are aware of their history as well as folk over here are aware of that particular history. Because, I mean, the thing we all need to remember when it comes to issues connected to enslavement is that it was so heinous. It was so wicked, I'm going to use that term, wicked, it was so evil, and it was based around violence and terror, that when it was abolished, in theory, in 1834/1838, we drew a line under it, and we kind of collectively sought to expunge it from our memories, so nobody spoke about it. So if you go to the Caribbean even now, there's very little that tells you, in terms of visual signs, that sort of explain this particular history. So, you know, chatting to my mom, God bless her, she's passed on now, about this particular history, she couldn't tell you. There was nothing in any history books that she, because she was taught an English curriculum. So, you know, it's interesting that, you know, my mom, you know, God bless her, would, you know, you've got the Odyssey at the moment, and I remember she would tell me about, you know, Homer and Odysseus and Polyphemus, the you know, the one-eyed, well, I suppose you call him the Cyclops, but it was all, and she used to say Polyphemus. I just think you're making this up. I don't know where you're getting this stuff from. It's only when I went to school and read about it that I realized she was right, because it seemed a bit odd, somebody called Polyphemus, and poly means many, and they've just got one eye. It just seemed a contradiction in terms. But she knew all about that. She got a classical English education, but what she didn't get was anything that taught her about her own history and about the history of Jamaica and the history of enslavement. And the weird thing was, the first book that spoke about this history was, in particularly in Jamaican context, was called A History of Jamaica. I've probably got it in my bookshelf here, by a man called Clinton V. Black in 1962. The irony is, Clinton V. Black was actually a white guy, but he wrote about the history of Jamaica, and he wrote about how the Africans arrived. And, you know, like I said, I was in Jamaica a couple of weeks ago. And what's interesting about Jamaica is that you go there and there is a Discovery Bay. So Discovery Bay is where Christopher Columbus first arrived. And he discovered Jamaica. He discovered an island where people were living there already. I don't know how you do that, but that's one thing. But what you never get a sense of is how the Africans arrived. Where did they arrive? You know, what happened to them when they arrived? How did they end up in different parts as enslaved people of the island? There is no sense of any kind of record or even monument or any sort of thing that sort of recognizes that. People don't want to talk about that. And it's a similar thing here. I don't know about you, but when I was growing up in school, we never had one lesson that explored the transatlantic slave trade. Not one lesson. I went to university. No, when I did my A-levels, no, we didn't discover it then. I did economic and social history. There was a one book that looked at Britain during the Industrial Revolution, was it called? Yeah, from industry to empire. So it's talking about 1700 to 1850. And it had half a page on slavery, just half a page. So this is something that we just, you know, we've sought to kind of ignore right out of history. So a part of this work involves actually writing back into history what we've sought to deliberately sideline and ignore. And I think if people actually get to engage with this particular history properly and see the brutality and the savagery of it, because you're talking about an endeavor or an activity that lasted centuries, that shaped the whole geography and the demographics of the Americas. You know, I'm sure you're aware of this, but, you know, when it comes to African people and where they live, the country that has the most African people in it, in terms of most populous country, is Nigeria. And the country that has the second highest number of people of African heritage is Brazil. And that's solely because of the slave trade. And the Portuguese were the prime movers in the transatlantic slave trade. And you go to Brazil now and, you know, at least half of the Brazilian population is of African ancestry. So that's people who look like me, but it's also people who virtually look like Meghan Markle, but also have, they call them café con leche, you know, coffee with a little milk in them, you know. But that's a history, that's the history of slavery. But people write it out of history. But that's how massive it was in terms of transforming the demographics of the Americas. But we ignore it. You go to America, they don't talk about it. You go to Cuba, they don't talk about it. You go to Venezuela, and I travel to all these places, they don't talk about it. That's the only thing they have in common. So when it comes to having conversations about reparations and then saying money, people just think, well, all you're going to do is give this money to these black people and they're totally undeserving of it. And then people, in a way, unhelpfully, just kind of connect reparations to money and not recognize that it's more holistic than that, and it has to be more holistic than that. But a part of it, a lot of it, is about education, both formally, formal education and informal education, so that we kind of we get a better understanding of the humongous nature of what took place over centuries and how that really, as I've said, transform the demographics of the Americas. But also, you think of this country and how that kind of, African enslavement and the products that the Africans produce helped to transform the economies here. You know, there's a book by an academic called Joseph Inikori, and it's about Africans and the British Industrial Revolution. And in it, he puts forward some very cogent arguments as to how the profits that were accrued from the transatlantic slave trade helped to foment the British Industrial Revolution. And what's fascinating also is the fact that, I don't know if you're aware of this, but, you know, the University of UCL, they've got their slave, register. So they've produced, I've got a database. And in this database, you get lists of the names of the individuals who were compensated for their enslaved Africans in the 1830s. And what's interesting is, some of them actually, in terms of the money that they got, they then put that money into different activities and enterprises. And one such individual was it was Harriet Watt, his family,
famous industrialist.
Yes, exactly, yeah. And developments, particularly in the steam industry, which obviously we know in terms of trains. And it's fascinating stuff. So when individuals tell you that enslavement was peripheral, African enslavement was peripheral to the economic interests of Britain, that's clearly not the case, because had it been peripheral, it wouldn't have taken people like Wilberforce and Clarkson and then the Clapham sect and the Quakers at least 30 years to then abolish the slave trade, and then another 27 years after that to abolish slavery in itself. And this was a hard-fought, hard-won campaign, and they were up against massive vested interests who were saying that this industry is vital to the interests, the financial interests of Britain. And again, you read the history books, and in history, particularly in the 18th century, if you wanted to know how rich a person was, you would say, well, this individual is as rich as a West Indian planter. So basically you're saying that, remember in the 70s you had all these, when oil prices were crazy, and you'd have all these oil barons, either from America or from the Middle East, and they would be buying up all kinds of things. And he says, he's got money because he's in oil. Well, in the 18th century, if you were involved in the sugar industry, you had money. And arguably the first millionaire in this country was a man called William Beckford, who was involved. He had plantations in Jamaica, and he was arguably the first millionaire in Britain. So you're talking about something that is lucrative. Sugar was like oil, and it was all slave produced, and it was massive. But again, we kind of ignore this. So we need to know the history. But people in the Caribbean need to know the history. We need to know the history. But also going back to the whole conversation about reparations, it's a part of a process, and education is a key part of this. And it's about collaboration. It's about conversations. You need to go to the people and say, well, what do you need, rather than people imposing their will or their values or their ideas on them, which is part of a problem in the first place. That's colonialism for you. So you shouldn't adopt a colonialist like attitude or approach to reparations. It needs to be about consultation. It needs to be about relationships. It needs to be, as I say, a part of a process. Just give people money and run off. That's not how you get true repair.
And remembering history, I think, is a profoundly Christian act, isn't it? You think about stories in the Old Testament about how much God urges the ancient Israelites to remember how I brought you out of slavery, and he instructs them to build monuments in the promised land so that they don't forget.
Yeah.
So I think you can see that, like, conscious, willful choosing to remember even the bits of our past we don't want to remember is an act of kind of honoring to God, to say we're not going to just push this down. We're going to actually honor, we're going to pay heed to our sins, but we're also honor the work of God that was at work in, and I'm often so struck by how vibrant the black church is in this country, when, if we're honest, black people have every excuse to want to turn their backs on Christianity, given it was so often used as a weapon to oppress and enslave them.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's fascinating, isn't it? Because you kind of think to yourself, virtually every kind of, you look at the civil rights movement in the United States, and it was church based, it was a Christian based movement. And if you look at, particularly in the US context, virtually every individual who has stood up and fought against oppression or marginalization or racism has been a church individual, somebody from the church. And this, you're talking about whether, Denmark Vesey or Nat Turner or Frederick Douglass, or even Marcus Garvey, came from a religious background. And then obviously you've got the modern civil rights movement, and you've got the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Martin Luther King, and the other individuals connected to that. So African people have been able, despite the attempts of individuals to brainwash them, to be able to look at the scriptures and see something in them, particularly in the life of Jesus Christ, that speaks to freedom, you know. And they had the ability, the wherewithal to actually, I would say, a hermeneutic read, to interpret scripture in a particular way, which suggests that, you know, God is on the side of the oppressed. And in Christ, you can see a savior who stands alongside those on the margins. And, you know, to use that as inspiration to actually then seek to fight for what some would call their rights. So, yeah, you see that in America, you've seen it in the Caribbean, you see it even in this church. But I think the other fascinating thing is that the numbers of people who stayed in historic churches, whether you're talking about the Church of England, or you're talking about the Methodist or the Baptist Church, or, you know, the, what we now call the United Reformed Church, people who did face racism, but said, you know, I'm not going, you know, these individuals who call themselves Christians are not Christians. I know what being a Christian is, and these folk aren't Christians, and they're not going to drive me away. I'm going to stay here and worship my God. And I think it still is the case that, you know, when it comes to black people in the church, two-thirds of them worship in the historic churches, Catholics and Methodists and Church of England, and only a third worship in Pentecostal churches. So I think, you know, there is a narrative, isn't there, right? Virtually every black person is by default a Pentecostal. Well, no, that's not the case. I'm not Pentecostal. I never worshipped in a few Pentecostal churches, but I was, you know, christened in a Methodist church, attended a Baptist church, went back to the Methodist church, and now I'm Church of England. And there are plenty of people like me, you know, who worship in historic churches, who, you know, they can tell you some pretty fruity tales about, you know, some of the experiences that they've had in these denominations. But you're not going anywhere. You know, you understand your ground. You know, you know who God is, and we know who Jesus stands for. And
that, for me, is a massive sign of hope, I think, as we kind of draw this to an end, is that the power of the gospel and the real person of Jesus is powerful enough even to overcome that, you know, as we saw about earlier, the kind of blasphemous, sinful attempts by some of my forebears in the church to kind of suppress that. Is that even as, you know, the church was complicit in so much racial injustice and oppression, the gospel is bigger and more powerful than that. And these, you know, communities can continue to kind of see that the true Jesus stands against everything that the enslavers claim
for
useful.
Me, in wrapping up, it has to be about hope, because, you know, Jesus is the hope of the nations, and we've got to have that hope in Jesus. And also this issue of transformation. You know, you think of, is it 2 Corinthians 5, verse 17, which, you know, speaks about our relationship, you know, with God because of Christ and our relationship with one another. And it's about, to me, transformation. It's about changing, us being more Christ-like, being more caring, being more loving, in terms of being able to look at our neighbor and love our neighbor. So the idea is that we are who we are at the moment, but the idea is that we should be transformed by the love of Christ. And it's a love that compels us. So we should be seeking to be more like Christ. We should seek to be transformed, particularly into his image. Now, when I look at issues around reparations and even racial justice, the end point, the aim is about reconciliation. That's what it should be about, bringing and showing that we are one, all one in Christ. So that's the end goal. How we get there now is, of course, I always say we need to traverse the racial justice highway, and it's full of potholes, it's full of obstacles. But what it means is that, you know, we need the power of the Holy Spirit to help us, to transform us, as we actually traverse this particularly troublesome route towards reconciliation. But the main thing is that we do it together. You know, we walk together. And to use the language of, I used to work for Christian Aid, we leave no one behind, you know, so we take people with us. But ultimately, it's, you know, it's a journey, you know, and they always say, oh, a journey starts with a step. So the whole thing about reconciliation, it's part of our particular continuum towards justice, racial justice, true justice and reconciliation. And I'll leave it there.
Brilliant. Well, thanks so much for your time, Richard. It's been a really interesting conversation. Really grateful for all that you've shared with us. And we'd love to know some of the listeners' thoughts. If you've been listening in and you have things you'd like to chip in or questions you'd like to ask, or even things you disagreed about what you've been hearing, we'd love to hear what listeners say. Please get in touch with us. You can always email molad, M-O-L-A-D, at premier.org.uk. But otherwise, we'll be back next week with another episode. And until then, bye-bye.
Of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.